I'm dermatologist and hair specialist Dr. Jeff Donovan, and I'd like to welcome you to the Evidence-Based Hair Podcast. Welcome to the Evidence-Based Hair Podcast for the June 27, 2022 issue. This is Season 2, Episode 6. Evidence-Based Hair is a podcast produced by the Donovan Hair Academy and addresses new research in the field of hair loss. We'll use our time together not only to talk about what's new, but to reflect on how all this new information ties in with everything we've come to learn in the past, and we'll think carefully about where we're heading in the future as a hair loss community. I'll use various studies each week as a pivot point to discuss key diagnostic pearls and treatment tips that hopefully allow us all to become better practitioners. This podcast was created for practitioners of various backgrounds, but regardless of whether you care for patients with hair loss or simply care about the topic of hair loss, this podcast will be of interest. This podcast was created for educational purposes and shouldn't be considered a substitute for medical advice. The fourth Monday of each week is dedicated to a variety of topics in the field of hair loss, and today we'll talk about five studies from the past few months in the area of hair loss. We'll begin by talking about JAK inhibitors and skin cancer, non-melanoma skin cancer, melanoma, and Merkel cell carcinoma. Data to date suggests that JAK inhibitors are associated with an increased risk of these types of skin cancers, and we'll take a look at an interesting study from the Vigibase World Health Organization database. Then we'll turn our attention to isotretinoin lab testing. What tests should we be ordering? Well, a really helpful study from the acne literature tells us that it's probably pretty simple for most people. An ALT and triglycerides before you start, and then soon after starting, is probably sufficient for most people, at least based on a Delphi consensus type study. Then we'll talk about the use of isotretinoin in surgery. Do we really need to stop isotretinoin in patients undergoing surgery? Well, we'll look at an interesting report which allows us to discuss this topic a bit further. And we'll take a look at some very important studies from 2017 as well, which give us some framework for answering this question. We use isotretinoin in the hair loss world for frontal fibrosing alopecia, for dissecting cellulitis, for folliculitis decalvans, and other conditions as well. What do we do when patients are going for surgery? What do we tell the surgeon? Do we really need to stop isotretinoin? Do we need to stop for a long time? When do we restart it? Well, we'll take a look at this important literature. Then we'll take a look at temporal triangular alopecia. Temporal triangular alopecia generally affects the temple area, and it's a triangular or lancet-shaped area of hair loss that starts usually age 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and it can mimic alopecia areata, but it doesn't grow back. Interesting data in the literature, which we'll review today, suggests that about 13% of individuals with this triangular alopecia actually have an atypical form which doesn't even affect the temples at all. So we'll take a look at that very interesting literature and a report of a patient with Down syndrome who had the findings of triangular alopecia on the vertex scalp. So clearly this temporal triangular alopecia term is not the ideal term, but it's this triangular shaped area of hair loss that is associated with vellus hairs and very much mimics alopecia areata, except there's no broken hairs, no exclamation mark hairs, and it doesn't respond to corticosteroids. And then we'll take a look at an interesting study of hydroxychloroquine dosing or Plaquenil dosing. The data from the literature tells us that there's a significant number of patients out there that are receiving too high of doses of hydroxychloroquine. The recommendations in the 2016 recommendations of the American Academy of Ophthalmology are that we shouldn't be exceeding 5 milligrams per kilogram. The literature tells us that there's a lot of patients that are getting too high of doses of hydroxychloroquine. And we'll take a look at an interesting study whereby a warning system was implemented in the electronic medical records such that when hydroxychloroquine was prescribed, if the doses were higher than 5 mg per kilogram or higher than 400 mg per day, a warning was given to the clinicians. How well did this work to reduce the chances of patients being excessively dosed? The references for all of these studies are in the show notes that accompany this episode. So let's begin then by talking about a very interesting study in May 2022 looking at skin cancers associated with JAK inhibitors. It's well recognized that some of the JAK inhibitors are associated with an increased risk of cancer. This is based on a large number of studies. The product monographs also warn about this. The studies that we've reviewed here in the past have taught us that there may be an increased risk for various types of cancers. There may be an increased risk for skin cancer as well, and that includes the non-melanoma and melanoma-type skin cancers. And so authors from France set out to examine the risk of skin cancer by looking into the VigiBase database, which is a database housed by the World Health Organization, whereby all sorts of different side effects from medications can be recorded and stored in its extremely large database. And it helps us better understand adverse drug reactions, especially in the post-FDA approval world or the post-approval world. After a drug is approved, it enters the so-called phase four of clinical study, whereby companies are responsible for evaluating safety of medications, but there's also responsibility of clinicians and patients to report side effects that might occur to these various regulatory bodies and to these various databases. And that's what the VigiBase database is. And so when you look into the database, if you find that the drug you're interested in has a higher risk of a certain type of side effect compared to other types of drugs in the database, then it may suggest that the drug of interest is associated with that side effect. It doesn't prove it, but it suggests. And so if you want to know if JAK inhibitors are associated with an increased risk of skin cancer, you can look into the Vigi database, the VigiBase database, and look at patients that have used the various JAK inhibitors and the risk of the reportings for skin cancer, and then look at the reportings for those same types of skin cancers in patients using other drugs. And so the authors examined the rates of reporting for squamous cell carcinoma, Merkel cell carcinoma, and melanoma. They calculated the so-called information component, or IC. The IC represents the strength of an association. So if the calculations show that there's a positive IC, then it indicates that the JAK inhibitor may be more likely to be associated with that particular type of cancer compared to other drugs in the database. And so in this study from May, a disproportionality signal, or an IC well above zero, was present for ruxolitinib, tofacitinib, and baricitinib. Squamous cell carcinoma with ruxolitinib was identified, as well as for tofacitinib. An increased risk for melanoma with ruxolitinib and tofacitinib was identified in this VigiBase database pharmacovigilance study, as well as an increased risk for Merkel cell carcinoma with both ruxolitinib and tofacitinib, but also baricitinib. A helpful study which reminds us that we need to be thinking about the possibility of skin cancer in patients using JAK inhibitors, and we need to follow our patients very carefully. We need to evaluate them before they start JAK inhibitors with skin exams to make sure there's no skin cancers to start, and then we periodically need to be examining the skin to see if there's any potential skin cancers that are developing. So that's a part of long-term follow-up. The recommendations are not well set for baricitinib, for example, that was just FDA approved for alopecia areata. The product monograph doesn't give specific recommendations on that, but certainly yearly skin exams are probably appropriate for many patients. And so I really like this study. I think it's important. It tells us that we need to continue to study this area very closely. These types of pharmacovigilance studies don't necessarily prove the association, but they certainly suggest that there may be this association. And the rates of squamous cell carcinoma, melanoma, and Merkel cell carcinoma may be increased by the use of JAK inhibitors. Ruxolitinib and tofacitinib have been around since 2011, 2012. That's when they first got their FDA approval. Baricitinib's only been around since 2018, so it makes sense that a lot of data is not quite out for baricitinib yet. But we haven't heard a lot about Merkel cell carcinoma, and Merkel cell carcinoma is a type of skin cancer with serious consequences, as does some types of melanoma have serious consequences. Squamous cell carcinoma can, but it's not as common to have, you know, very serious life-threatening consequences, although it certainly can. But Merkel cell carcinoma has a mortality of around 30%, and these are challenging to diagnose sometimes and often missed. So I think this is a really important study. It just reminds us that this topic of skin cancer with JAK inhibitors is relevant, and we need to be thinking more about it. We need to continue to study it. Not only do the companies need to study this post-marketing if they bring a JAK inhibitor to market, but I think these databases like the VigiBase database and other post-marketing studies are going to be really important to help us understand the increased risk of various types of cancers with JAK inhibitors. Right now, we're of the opinion that certainly in older individuals, 50 years of age and over, who have rheumatoid arthritis, who have used tofacitinib, for example, and have previously been on methotrexate, that there may be an increased risk of cancer. That's the so-called oral surveillance study that we've talked about in the past. I think that some of us are of the opinion that that data really doesn't apply to our younger patients about to start JAK inhibitors for alopecia areata or other scarring alopecias. I think that's a little bit nearsighted or biased in the way we're thinking about that. I think the data is there that there is likely to be an increased risk of cancer with the use of these medications. Is it different risk in a 50-year-old than a 20-year-old? Probably. But I think we really need to do these studies, and I think it's really, really important that we remember that. We don't have long-term follow-up data with any of the JAK inhibitors. Sure, we have 10 years of follow-up data with tofacitinib, ruxolitinib. But we don't have 20 years and 30 years data, and patients with alopecia areata, for example, that start JAK inhibitors will need to use it 20 and 30 years or until another medication comes out. Some patients with alopecia areata may be able to stop, but most patients will need continued use of the drug. So these cancer-related studies are really important, and I really like this study, and the references are in the show notes if you'd like to look at it yourself. We move now to a study looking at the lab tests that we should be ordering in patients who use isotretinoin. Isotretinoin is a medication which is well known for acne. And in fact, it first came to market in 1982. It has several different trade names. The drug is used in the hair loss clinic. I use isotretinoin for frontal fibrosing alopecia. It's a very important drug in frontal fibrosing alopecia, sometimes in lichen planopilaris, often in folliculitis decalvans, often in dissecting cellulitis. So it's a very important drug in the hair clinic, especially in scarring alopecia. And it's critically important for hair specialists to know what blood tests to perform when you're about to start a patient on isotretinoin, and then what blood test to perform in follow-up. Certainly one can order every blood test on the blood test requisition sheet and just tick off all the boxes, but that's not really very logical. And so what are the blood tests that really make a lot of sense? What's so interesting is that the original product monograph, when the drug came to market, certainly encouraged prescribers to monitor cholesterol and triglycerides and liver function tests very often, weekly or biweekly, until there was some stabilization. But there's been a lot of data recently suggesting that this type of frequent routine monitoring doesn't have any evidence to support such close monitoring with such an array of blood tests. And the reality is that even if mild abnormalities are found, they don't usually affect the treatment plan. For many of these slight changes, a patient doesn't need to stop or adjust their dose in any way. So a very nice study very recently looked at the views of acne experts on what lab tests are relevant in patients with acne. And so this was a Delphi-type study where you assess the opinions and the views, whether participants agree or disagree with certain types of statements. That's what these Delphi studies are all about. If 70% or more of participants agree on a certain statement, then you declare that it's a consensus. And so in this particular study, there were 22 acne experts. And they agreed on the following four statements. That we need to check ALT, liver enzymes, a month before starting isotretinoin and at peak dose. But we don't need to check it monthly and we don't need to check it after stopping treatment. We should check triglycerides a month before starting and at peak dose. But we don't need to check it monthly and we don't need to check it after stopping. We don't need to check complete blood counts or CBCs at any point during isotretinoin treatment. And we don't need to check GGT, liver enzymes, bilirubin, albumin, total protein, LDL, HDL, or CRP. And so it comes down to being a pretty simple array of blood tests that we should be checking ALT and triglycerides. And we should check these before starting, ideally within a month of starting, and then after peak levels. So generally within 6 to 8 weeks. And the other tests really aren't as relevant for us to be testing. Now, there are certain circumstances where, of course, for a given patient, you might want to check. But this was the consensus that was reached in this Delphi study. And I think it's a really helpful study, which reminds us that the blood tests for isotretinoin are actually pretty simple. We have triglycerides and we have ALT. And so I think this is a really helpful study. I think that having this type of consensus in the literature really helps. I think it helps us understand what might be considered more of a standard of care. Clearly, if you have 22 acne experts and you're reaching consensus on these four statements, then that's pretty close to a standard of care. And so the other blood tests aren't necessarily standard of care. And so when we think about evidence-based, cost-effective ordering of blood tests, it's ALT and triglycerides. Another study looks at isotretinoin use in patients about to undergo surgery, and it's titled Oral Isotretinoin Roaccutane Use During Incisional Surgery, Safe or Risky, published in May of 2022. And so there's been a concern for many years that patients that use isotretinoin shouldn't undergo surgery because the wounds, the healing of the incision site might be suboptimal. And some of this fear stemmed from some basic science studies showing that retinoids suppress collagenase activity and it might promote excessive collagen accumulation and hypertrophic scarring or keloid-type scarring. And some of that fear came from 1986, when a study by Rubinstein showed that there was some atypical keloids that formed in patients with isotretinoin that were undergoing dermabrasion. And so a nice report by Davis and Perkins shows two female patients who underwent breast reduction surgery while using isotretinoin and had very good outcomes, and there was no excessive type scarring in the incisions. And so certainly it seems that isotretinoin doesn't need to be stopped for most types of surgeries. However, I'd like to review with you some important literature which starts accumulating in 2017, which gives us some really important guidance in terms of what to advise patients, surgeons, colleagues, and maybe even the work that we do in patients that are on isotretinoin. Even though we might not need to avoid incisional surgery, there is evidence to support delaying mechanical dermabrasion and fully ablative laser therapy. And so there's two studies from 2017 that I'll include in the show notes. One is by Spring and colleagues in JAMA Dermatology, and one is by Mysore in the Journal of Cutaneous and Aesthetic Surgery. These are both from 2017. So let's take a look at these two reports together. They're very helpful, and they form an important basis for the recommendations that I give almost every day in the clinic to colleagues, etc. So in 2017, a panel of experts put forth recommendations on the safety of isotretinoin in patients undergoing dermatologic procedures. And so Spring and colleagues reviewed 32 publications, which reported the outcomes of over 1,485 procedures. And overall, the authors concluded that there was insufficient evidence to support delaying manual dermabrasion, superficial chemical peels, cutaneous surgery, laser hair removal, fractional ablative and non-ablative laser procedures for patients currently receiving or having recently completed isotretinoin therapy. And so based on the literature, the authors stated that mechanical dermabrasion and fully ablative lasers are not recommended. Those are the two things that are not recommended in patients receiving isotretinoin. In 2017, Mysore and colleagues published a report which is very similar. This is a report from the Association of Cutaneous Surgeons of India, and they put forth the recommendation that there is insufficient evidence to support the current protocol of avoiding and delaying treatments in the patient groups under consideration having received isotretinoin, and that current practice should be discontinued. The task force concluded that performing surgeries for laser hair removal, fractional lasers for aging, acne scarring, lasers for pigmented skin lesions, fractional radiofrequency microneedling, superficial and medium depth peels, microdermabrasion, dermarollers, biopsies, radiofrequency ablation, and superficial excisions are safe in patients with current or recent isotretinoin administration. And Mysore and colleagues also put forward the very helpful statement, which I really like, and it's not always intuitive, but that is that instead of avoiding some of these procedures, a test procedure can be considered to establish the safety in any given patient. So I really like these studies, Spring and colleagues, Mysore and colleagues. I think that if you're a surgeon, you perform any of these cosmetic procedures, you need to know Spring and colleagues 2017. You need to know Mysore and colleagues 2017. If you are a hair loss specialist and you use isotretinoin and you are recommending, you are advising patients about what to do if they want to have these types of procedures, you need to review Mysore and colleagues and Spring and colleagues 2017. So these are really important publications which give us some guidance in terms of what to think about in patients undergoing these types of procedures. So we move now to a topic that we don't talk about a lot, and that's congenital triangular alopecia, sometimes called temporal triangular alopecia, but it's really best called congenital triangular alopecia because it doesn't always involve the temples, as we'll see now. Congenital triangular alopecia is a type of hair loss which starts sometimes at birth, but not always. Even though it's called congenital, you know, it often starts age 2, 3, 4, generally before age 8 or 9. And it's this triangular or lancet-shaped area, often in the temples, whereby the apex or the peak points to the crown. And it happens in the temples most often. It happens above the lateral eyebrow and to the side of the lateral eyebrow in most cases. And so if you draw a line up from the lateral aspect of the eyebrow, the triangle of congenital triangular alopecia occurs lateral to that line. And inui in 2012 put forward some criteria for congenital triangular alopecia, that it's a triangular area of hair loss in the temples. Trichoscopy shows vellus hairs with normal follicular openings. There's no black dots, no dystrophic hairs, no loss of ostia, which would suggest alopecia areata or scarring alopecia, and no hair regrowth that happens. And so Starace and colleagues in 2020 published a very nice report that I think is really important to know about. This was a study of 78 patients with congenital triangular alopecia. 68 patients had pretty typical congenital triangular alopecia of the temples, or what we would call in the past temporal triangular alopecia. But 10 patients had an atypical pattern. It wasn't in the temples. 5 had this triangular area of hair loss in the occiput area. 4 had parietal involvement and 1 had vertex involvement. So that's 13% of patients with congenital triangular alopecia have an atypical presentation. And this is available free online. And the authors show a couple of these cases, very nice, of the triangular shape with these numerous vellus hairs in the area, not showing any particular features suggestive of alopecia areata. So Shimrata and colleagues published a nice report this year of congenital triangular alopecia associated with Down syndrome. The patient that they describe was a 4-year-old boy with Down syndrome who had this patch of non-scarring alopecia. It didn't improve with corticosteroids. It was a triangular-shaped non-scarring patch in the vertex. Trichoscopy showed the vellus hairs, white hairs, empty follicles, no features suggestive of alopecia areata. And they published this report free online and show the very nice pictures and trichoscopy that accompany this particular case, with many of these vellus hairs and white hairs present, and some of these follicular openings that are present. And so another nice report of an atypical presentation of congenital triangular alopecia, this time a report of an association with Down syndrome. Congenital triangular alopecia can rarely be associated with various congenital and genetic type conditions. It's not common, but Yamazaki published a nice report in 2010 describing congenital triangular alopecia with Down syndrome, the Dandy-Walker malformation, and phacomatosis pigmentovascularis, another type of genetic-related abnormality. And so we certainly have to be on the lookout for these types of abnormalities, but I think that it's just critical in any child with hair loss, no matter what the cause is, that we take good histories in children. If a child is presenting with alopecia areata or telogen effluvium or congenital triangular alopecia, histories are really important. What is the birth history? What is the health of the mother? Was the baby born at term, prematurely, post-dates? Was there any complications in labor and delivery? How was the growth during the first several months? Was the child breastfed, bottle-fed? What's the family history? These types of questions are very important in all children that we see with any type of hair loss. And I think it's important to get into that habit of really taking good histories in children, because it often can be relevant and important in some cases. And so finally, we turn to a report looking at the safety of hydroxychloroquine. And the fourth Monday of each month is often dedicated to safety when we talk about these various potpourri of studies. And today we've talked about JAK inhibitor safety and the side effects of skin cancers. We've talked about isotretinoin safety and the lab tests that we need to order to keep isotretinoin dosing safe. We've talked about the safety of isotretinoin in patients about to undergo surgery. And here we're talking about the safety of hydroxychloroquine on the retinal-related side effects. Hydroxychloroquine is a medication which is commonly used in various types of hair loss, non-scarring hair loss, like systemic lupus, rarely dermatomyositis, but particularly scarring alopecia, frontal fibrosing alopecia, lichen planopilaris, discoid lupus. These are all reasons why we use hydroxychloroquine in the clinic. A very popular trade name is Plaquenil. Hydroxychloroquine can increase the risk of retinopathy, or this particular disease of the back of the eye called the retina. Fortunately, it's not very common, and within the first 10 years of use, about 2% of patients have retinopathy. If the dose is respected and kept at 5 milligrams per kilogram or less, those are the statistics that we can tell patients. The problem is that many patients are receiving too high of doses of hydroxychloroquine. And a very nice study in JAMA Ophthalmology from 2014 by Melison Marmor tell us that the risk of retinopathy is 1% after 5 years, 2% after 10 years. And if we respect those doses, then we can conclude that that's the risk to expect. So Melison Marmor performed a nice study in 2014 whereby they looked at 2,361 patients who used hydroxychloroquine continuously for at least 5 years. And then patients underwent various types of visual field testing, optical coherence tomography, and the purpose was to look at toxicity of hydroxychloroquine. And what Melis and Marmor concluded in that 2014 study, that very important JAMA ophthalmology study, was that the risk of retinopathy is 1% after 5 years and 2% after 10 years. And if you continue it for more than that, it goes up to 20% at 20 years, but pretty good safety in the first 10 years. So hydroxychloroquine is used in the Hera Clinic, as I mentioned, for all these various types of scarring and non-scarring alopecias. We need to respect that dose of 5 milligrams per kilogram. But despite these 2016 guidelines that were put forth by the American Academy of Ophthalmology to keep the dose at 5 milligrams per kilogram and never to exceed 400 milligrams, even if a patient is slightly heavier weight, that many patients still are receiving too high of doses. And a 2021 study by Chen and colleagues in ophthalmology suggested that about 27% of patients in the outpatient population are receiving too high of doses of hydroxychloroquine. So it's surprising that there's this large proportion of patients out there that are getting the wrong dose. And by getting the wrong dose, there's 27% of patients out there that are increasing their risk of retinopathy when they don't need to be. And so a new study from the Cleveland Clinic and Case Western University looked at the value of a clinical decision support tool that was part of the electronic medical record, so that if patients were prescribed hydroxychloroquine and they were prescribed more than 5 milligrams per kilogram dosing or more than 400 milligrams, that a warning would pop up in the computer system saying, you're prescribing higher than the recommended dose. And so what's the value of this type of system that can be attached to the electronic medical records? And so they compared the frequency or the proportion of patients receiving too high of doses before the system was implemented, and then the rates after the system was implemented. And there was over 7,000 patients that were studied. The mean dose decreased from 340 milligrams pre-intervention to 324 after this computer warning system was implemented. Before the warning system was implemented, there was about 0.8% of prescriptions that were above 400 milligrams. And then once the warning system was implemented, there was only 0.22%. So about 1/4 of the prescriptions written that were above 400 milligrams. But overall, excessive dosing decreased from 27% to 21%. So there was a 29% reduction thanks to this computer system. So who was most likely to get the incorrect doses still? Well, patients with low body weight were 76 times more likely to get the wrong dose and to be excessively dosed compared to patients of normal body weight. 76 times higher. That's a really remarkable number. And patients that were given their hydroxychloroquine by a non-rheumatology doctor were almost twofold more likely to get a too high of a dose. And so when I see a patient who's already on hydroxychloroquine, or I'm about to start a patient on hydroxychloroquine, I pull up a table that we have on the Donovan Medical website, which shows the dosing according to weight. You ask the patient their weight, you punch it in into pounds or kilograms, you convert it to kilograms, and then you multiply it by 5. And you need to respect this 5 milligram per kilogram dosing and not go higher than that. I often work in pounds because many patients are still comfortable working in pounds, but for European patients, we work in kilograms, and other patients around the world, we work in kilograms. But the key point is that we're programmed to think often that the dose of hydroxychloroquine is 2 of these little 200 milligram pills a day, 400 milligrams a day. That's just not correct, and that's where the errors go wrong. The dose is based on weight, and you only use 400 milligram dosing if the patient is 180 pounds or more. And if the patient is less than 180 pounds, then you're going to use less than 400 milligrams per day. And to convert 180 pounds to kilograms, you divide by 2.2. So 180 pounds is 81 kilograms. So unless you're 81 kilograms, or unless you're 180 pounds, you should not be getting 400 milligrams a day. And so as your weight starts dropping, you're going to be decreasing the amount of hydroxychloroquine that you get each day. And if you have a patient that is under 110 pounds, or 110 divided by 2.2, which is 50, so if you have a patient that's under 50 kilograms or 110 pounds, they're only going to get one pill a day or 200 milligrams every day of the week. And so we need to be dosing hydroxychloroquine according to weight. Some patients get one pill a day. Some patients get two pills a day if they're heavy enough. Some patients will get one pill on Monday, two pills on Tuesday, one pill on Wednesday. And sometimes some pharmacies will recommend that you take 300 milligrams a day, but usually I alternate the doses if we have patients that are between 130 pounds and 150 pounds. We alternate 200 and 400 milligrams. But the key is that we need to dose hydroxychloroquine according to weight, and not everyone gets two pills a day, 400 milligrams. In fact, you need to be over 180 pounds or 81 kilograms before that type of dosing applies. And so that's it for this week, everyone. I want to thank you very much for joining me again for this week of the Evidence-Based Hair Podcast. We talked about JAK inhibitors in skin cancers, squamous cell carcinoma, melanoma, and Merkel cell carcinoma. And we looked at a study which looked at the data from the VigiBase database, suggesting that there may be an increased signal for these three cancers in users of these JAK inhibitors. Ruxolitinib, tofacitinib have been around the longest, baricitinib the least of those three, but there is an increased risk of these types of cancers, and most concerning was the increased risk of Merkel cell carcinoma, which needs to be studied more. We looked at isotretinoin lab testing and a very nice study which addresses some of the confusion in terms of what lab tests should we be ordering and what lab tests are rather useless. And it's clear that we do need to be ordering lab tests before starting, and we do need to order lab tests after starting, but those lab tests might be limited to ALT and triglycerides. Those two tests before, and those two tests after. Of course, it's taken on a case-by-case basis. We often order pregnancy tests in women of childbearing age who are about to start isotretinoin, and periodically after they start, we sometimes order lab tests like CK, creatinine kinase, in patients that are reporting muscle pain or symptoms of that kind. If there's patients with other types of symptoms, then yes, we may order other tests on a case-by-case basis. But ALT and triglycerides are the most important tests. We talked about isotretinoin and surgery and the fact that wound healing is pretty good in patients about to undergo surgery on isotretinoin. And we looked at two very important reports, Mysore and colleagues from 2017 and Spring and colleagues from 2017, looking at the pretty good safety for many types of dermatologic and cosmetic procedures with isotretinoin. There are a few exceptions, but I think it's important to review those papers if you're a surgeon, or if you're a cosmetic physician, or if you're a hair specialist that uses isotretinoin. Then we took a look at congenital triangular alopecia and the fact that 13% of patients with congenital triangular alopecia have the patch of hair loss outside of the temples. And so the term is congenital triangular alopecia as opposed to temporal triangular alopecia. And a very nice study recently published looking at an association between congenital triangular alopecia of the vertex and a patient with Down syndrome. These types of associations are not common, but we need to be aware of that. And I reminded you of the importance of taking good histories of all of our pediatric patients, regardless of what type of hair loss issue they have. And then we talked about hydroxychloroquine dosing and what we can do as specialists to keep this drug as safe as possible. And that is to respect the dose and keep it less than 5 milligrams per kilogram. And if a patient is 250 or 300 pounds, we still max it out at 400 milligrams. We don't go beyond that. Despite this warning system implemented in the electronic medical record system at this large hospital, there was still 1 out of every 5 patients getting too high of doses of hydroxychloroquine. And so be on the lookout for excessive dosing. It's very common, and I see it very often in patients that are referred to me. Some patients come in on 400 milligrams. If you're 5'1" and 100 pounds, that's not the dose for you. The dose is 200 milligrams per day, or maybe 200 milligrams 5 days of the week. And there are patients that are of that weight. There are patients that are 90 pounds, and they shouldn't even be getting 200 milligrams a day. And so we need to respect the dose of hydroxychloroquine. And if we respect the dose, the chance of retinopathy is 1% at 5 years and 2% after 10 years. That means 98% of our patients will not have evidence of a retinopathy after a decade of use of this medication. Thanks again for joining me for this week's episode. I hope these studies were helpful. Please do refer to the show notes if you'd like more about these particular references. Next week, we're back for the first Monday of the month, and we're about to turn the calendar into the month of July. And the first Monday of each month is dedicated to androgenetic alopecia and alopecia areata. And so that will be the topics of the first Monday of July. We always value your comments and feedback. We're available by email at info@donovanhairacademy.com. I'll look forward to welcoming you back here next week for another episode of Evidence-Based Hair.